Well, greetings to you all. It's been a while to be able to have the privilege to be over here for the sermon, but I'm delighted. I was delighted with our sermonette, which really sets the platform for what I wanted to talk about. So thanks to Dr. Burkle for that. Loved it very much. Back in the May of 1940, at the onset of World War II, the German forces were driving the Allied forces backward, back toward the Atlantic Ocean. German tanks skillfully managed to maneuver through the Ardennes Forest and push the British British Army and that combined with the French Army back toward Belgium, back toward a peninsula called Dunkirk. At that point, the German tanks basically had the army pinned down, just like the Israelites at the Red Sea. Water in the back and an enemy in the front and nowhere to go. The Allied forces would be lucky to last another day. All their eggs were basically in that one basket, about 335 British troops alone, and they were pinned in. And everybody on the island of Great Britain, with bated breath, was wondering what would happen, because the future of the country hung in the balance, and it was a very dangerous, precarious time, to say the least. And so they were waiting for information from at least one of the commanding officers there at Dunkirk as to the ultimate status of the troops, the morale, what would happen, could they hold out, did they need to evacuate, what was going to happen. And the commander sent an interesting message. He sent back a three-word message. Instead of saying, well, here are the logistics, here are where we are located, here's where the Germans are coming in, the Luftwaffe is already dropping leaflets demanding that we surrender, that there is no hope, and it looks like there's no hope, just a three-word communique went back to the mainland. And the words were, but if not. But if not, that might have puzzled the Germans. How do you decode that? What's that all about? It has nothing to do with military strategy, nothing to do with logistics. But if not, we can't read anything into that. Yet the people on the island of Great Britain, or England, many of them immediately knew what that meant, and they resonated. In our secular England today, that message would have meant anything to the populace, but if not. And if I were to explain that to anybody in the United States, it may not, because of the secular situation in which we find our society. But back then, many more people read the Bible, and immediately a lot of them thought of Daniel chapter 3, Daniel's three friends at the fiery furnace, who, as we've already heard, had the temerity, the boldness, the conviction, the vision, the wisdom to stand in front of Nebuchadnezzar and say, we will not bow down and worship this idol. God is able to save us, but if not, we will not serve your God. That was the ultimate showdown, because Nebuchadnezzar, one thing about him, he had a volatile temper, and he had a huge ego. Not a good combination. And he had a rally that probably would dwarf a Nuremberg rally of the 1930s into something of great insignificance. By comparison, he probably had not just hundreds of thousands, but maybe a million or more people on the plain of Dura that were willing to bow down, worship this golden image that was 90 feet tall. It was to make a huge impression on the country. And why Nebuchadnezzar came up with this, we don't know. But he insisted that everybody bow down and worship it. And it created the ultimate challenge for Daniel's three friends. Several conclusions that we'll derive from this account is that God really monitors us closely, much more closely than we probably realize. We can think of Jeremiah 32, verse 27, which says, is there anything too hard for the Lord? That's nice to know in an academic setting. Yes, I can see we worship a great God. I know that's true. He's created wonderful things. But to really know it from the gut, to know it, to see it, to experience it, it takes it to a different level. So God monitors us closely. And is anything too hard for the Lord? No, it never is. And we have many examples of the Bible that reveal the character can be very impressive. The character of those three friends spoke volumes. We need to know that trials like that can either make us or break us. Make us or break us. When God allows us trials, He wants us to go through them. And our confidence and our trust in God should be rock solid. Now, could it be in every case? We have the comfort of knowing in 1 Corinthians 10:13, God will not tempt us above that which we are able to bear. But when I speak to you, I'm speaking to myself. I'm speaking 100%, spiritually speaking. Like all of you, I'm a work in progress. That's the way I view it. And it's humbling to say that, but it's the blunt truth of it all for all of us. But yet we have the potential with God's help. Now, without God's help, nothing's possible, really, on this level. But with God's help, we have the chance to be able to say and make the right decisions all the time, to say yes to what's right and no to what's wrong. At Dunkirk, when the word went out, but if not, the people there rallied. They knew that that was a quotation out of the Bible, out of Daniel 3. And it rallied them, the people, because they thought, well, there's fortitude among our troops. And as long as they draw breath, as long as there's time, we're going to try to rescue some of them. And that's what happened. It was hoped that maybe one-tenth of the forces could be extracted from Dunkirk. As I read one excerpt here from a historian, all of England knew the plight of their soldiers and were awaiting the news of almost certain annihilation of at least 350,000 brave men. And late on the night of May the 25th, a simple three-word cryptic message was transmitted across the airwaves of England from the commander of the British Army at Dunkirk. The message was, but if not, in a matter of hours, without any formal organization, thousands of English citizens got in their private boats and began heading across the English Channel towards their trapped soldiers. And the waters became unusually calm. The same English Channel that ripped up the Spanish Armada back in 1588 became unusually calm for this rescue effort. God looking over their shoulder or the arms underneath, as we saw in Deuteronomy 33. The boats were of every kind imaginable, from small fishing boats, trawlers, large private boats, and even an Olympic racing yacht. At the risk of their own lives from the dangerous waters and certain enemy fire, they raced to the beaches of Dunkirk and began evacuating the weary soldiers. And by the next day, all the troops had been rescued in what historians now call the miracle of Dunkirk. Changed the course of the war. But they had the attitude that they were going to persist no matter what, that they were not going to cave in, they were not going to surrender. That was an inspiration, of course, to their countrymen. I'd like for us to turn to Daniel 3. Because we see where the phrase, if not, but if not, indeed originates. I've quoted it. But if we look at the account, I think we can marvel at the demonstration of faith and conviction of these three men. Chapter 3, verse 1 of Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar made a gold statue 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Messages to the high officials and governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the provincial officials to come to the dedication of the statue that he had set up. So all those officials came and stood before the statue the king Nebuchadnezzar set up. And of course, it was a decree that at the right moment, when the music sounded, that everybody would bow down and worship this. Now, after it was done, there were some Jews, those three, that refuse to do that. And you can just imagine, with everybody bowing, maybe making noise, great adulation, either because they believed in what Nebuchadnezzar was doing or because they wanted to be look loyal. It's just like Joseph Stalin in one speech, well, in many speeches that he gave, the people were in the audience were afraid of him. And they would vociferously applaud. And nobody wanted to be the first one to quit applauding. So it would go on for minute after minute, 5 minutes of ovation. I don't know how they ever brought it to an end, but they were scared to death. And they thought that if they didn't give him the great and extended adulation, that they'd all be put to death. Because he was a ruthless man, and he did put to death multiple millions of Russians in the purges. So, knowing the volatility of a Nebuchadnezzar, I am sure the people made noise and wanted to go along with it. It would be so tempting to say, well, man, this is an awful situation. I'm in a terrible fix. God will understand if I kind of kneel down a little bit. He'll understand. That's true. He does. He always understands, but may not agree with our conclusions. No, I got a job and a family to protect, situation ethics. Better for me to compromise a little. Why, the king and with Daniel, we're doing a lot of good for his kingdom. If we just, God will look the other way, or we'll just sweep this one under the rug. We go, to get along, you got to go along. It's easy to come with rationalizations. That's one thing that human nature is good at. If you think of something that you know that's wrong to do, why, if you think, but what would be plausible reasons why I could justify it in my own mind? You come up with all kinds of ideas. But they're invalid. Those three knew that this was a trial. It was a challenge. A challenge of a demonstration of faith. And frankly, it's one that we might see in one shape, form, or another before Christ gets back to this earth. Because there are challenges out there. And God's Spirit can enable us to successfully meet the challenges that come our way. I'm certainly not saying that it was easy to do what these men did. I can imagine also that once it was decreed and they didn't bow down, it was going to be inevitable. Politicians in the midst of them, other people would probably murmur in order to ingratiate themselves with the king. Go, king, there are three people that didn't bow down. What are you going to do about it? Doesn't take much to set this guy off. He could go into a rage. And in other times in the Bible he did. He wanted to put his counselors all to death because they couldn't interpret his dream. And back in chapter 1, when the Jewish men asked one of the supervisors, can we eat certain food and not the king's diet? And he allowed it. He was risking his life. Yeah, boy, if the king finds out. And so the king was going to find out about these three not worshiping his image that he put together and that he had heavily promoted. And so we see that sure enough came up. Verse 12, different ones wanted to be the first to tell the king. There are some Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you've put in charge of the province of Babylon. I mean, this is serious. They're not following what you're saying. They pay no attention to you, your majesty. They refuse to serve your gods and do not worship the gold statue that you've set up. They tried as much as they could, with vocal inflection, with finger pointing and all, to make them look bad. Sounds like American politics. Make them look bad. By comparison, we're loyal. And challenge the status quo. They were jealous, I'm sure. They didn't want these outsiders with all the limelight. Why not take their place at their expense? Maybe deep down inside they were happy, but they had to put on this righteous indignation. These people are a threat to your kingdom. Verse 13, I'm reading from New Living Translation. Verse 3, what else is new? Then Nebuchadnezzar flew into a rage and ordered that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought before him. I don't know if that took 10 minutes or 15 or an hour, but that would be a long time to think about things. Oh boy, I'm going to get it. We're going before the king. What am I going to say? Or how am I going to say it? Is there any middle ground here? And it would be an opportunity, a time period to change one's mind. So Nebuchadnezzar knew these men. He had relied on them. Verse 14, he said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you refuse to serve my gods or worship the gold statue that I've set up?" I mean, you guys, you're intelligent. Why would you even do this? Why would you risk political suicide by doing such a thing? Then he said something that he normally would never say. Remember, in this time, it would be the Hammurabi Code, law of the Medes and the Persians, or even law of Babylon. "I've decreed it, so I've decreed, so it shall be, so I have said." And he breaks precedent by saying, "I'll give you another chance." And they're going to have to say the same answer. And that's going to get the king even more in a rage. But he valued their intelligence and wanted to salvage the situation. But he added, "But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace." And then he added something that is never a good idea to say with God paying attention. "And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power?" Just like Pharaoh said to Moses, "And who is this God of Israel that's going to deliver you out of my hand?" I think that gets under God's skin quite a bit. You read through Isaiah and other places, it irritates him when people claim that he doesn't even exist. And he says time and time again, "How can you think that way? How can you take wood and metal and fashion it into false pagan gods and then tell everybody that they need to worship them when you've got the true God that can do miracles?" So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, verse 16, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us, and he will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But if not, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will neither serve your gods nor worship the gold statue that you have set up." Well, if that wasn't a slap in the face. Nebuchadnezzar was so furious with these three that his face became distorted with rage. He commanded that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter than usual. I don't know how that happens. And it wouldn't happen in an instant. So maybe it's at 1,000 degrees, and what, is he going to heat it up to 10,000? I know my wife has a kiln that she makes pottery. It gets up to 2,000. Intense heat. When I cook a fish in the oven, and it's at 350 degrees, and I open it up, and this blast comes, to me that's overwhelming. Intimidating, 7 times hotter than what he originally intended. Remember, it was so hot that when certain servants of the king dragged these three, or maybe they marched in, I'm not sure, but accompanied them into the fiery furnace, they burned up. They had no choice. They would have been killed anyway. So it's lose if I do it, lose if I don't do it. They walked in and hoped that they would survive the flames, or at least getting close, and they burned up. But it took time to heat that fire up. Maybe it took a couple of hours. And here the three men could say, "Yeah, I made a bold statement, but hasn't happened yet. Time is still moving along. You know, it's not too late to change. You know, I could renege." It's one thing to make a bold statement, but then to have to stand behind it for hour after hour after hour till the flames are heated up. I think we're familiar with what happened. God chose, in this case, to protect them. They didn't even have the smell of smoke on them. And then Nebuchadnezzar was stultified to see a fourth man with them and the fact that they were still alive. And when he called for them to be released or to come out, then he said, there is no other God that can do such a thing. And he was humbled. Maybe he was bipolar, you know. I'm going to, you know, lower the boom. And then, oh, this is so amazing. I'm so humbled. Nothing wrong with bipolarity if we can get the help for that, of course, maybe medically or other ways. But in this case, Nebuchadnezzar was oftentimes out of control, and the people around him knew that quite well. God's purpose for trials is very broad. I remember hearing of one minister we had a long time ago. He was all of about 23 years of age. Wonderful age to be 23. I wish I were again. But at that point, he had been in the ministry for all of 5 weeks. He got a call in the middle of the night. There had been a horrible accident. And he was asked to go to the hospital and to anoint the surviving passenger, a girl. Other people in the, I think of her father, but other people were killed. Head-on collision was rather grisly, the results. She was in ICU. He had been on one or two hospital visits with his family to see people, you know, for smaller issues. But he had never been to an ICU room, and that's where she was. And he said he was very, very much taken aback by the fact that there were all these tubes running everywhere and a breathing device, and her teeth were all shattered, every bone in the rib cage basically broken, and all wired up and bundled, bandaged up. And he said he didn't even know where he would find a space to be able to lay hands on her to anoint her. And he said she couldn't talk, but her eyes followed him all around that small room. Plaintive eyes, like a puppy dog, you know, can you explain what's going on, what happened, what's going to happen to me and to the others? And so he kind of fumbled around a little bit, but then he started to talk about God can help you. God can, I'm anointing you. We're looking for things to improve, which they did. She couldn't talk. It was a one-sided, you know, conversation. And he said he had certain standard answers that he'd known of from others, that God is able to take care of it. And God's kingdom awaits all of us in one way or another at different times, depending on if others that we know that we're close to do die. He said he had the answers, but at that point they seemed a bit dry, a bit canned. He said they weren't, but he felt inadequate. He'd never seen such adversity, and yet sometimes adversity is part of life. But it brought to him a new awareness. Remember one person talked with the... He had been taken to an operating room for something that was quite serious. He said, they got me there too early, and so they just left me there in the hallway. And I'm listening to the conversation going on in the operating room, and it was kind of mundane. And then he said, I thought of myself, it was my reality moment, would I make it through? Would I wake up? What would happen? I can't do anything about it. Here I lay. Here I am. And how do I submit to God's perfect will? What is God's will? These are experiences that shape us and challenge us from time to time. I'd like to turn over to Job chapter 7. Job chapter 7. Let's see. Esther, Job. And sometimes adversities can happen to us, and we don't know why. Remember one man who gave a sermon once. He talked about the fact that he had cancer. And it was quite unsettling to him. And he did what I think a lot of people do. Well, if I have a certain challenge, a certain trial, well, I grit my teeth and I bear it through it. But if it's twice as bad as what I thought it was, well, I just tense up twice as much and forge my way ahead. Well, what if it's 100 times worse? Well, we can't get 100 times more tense or more focused. We would short out. We would cease to exist. Now, one of the keys with faith is, whether it's a big issue or a little issue, is you approach it the same way. You don't work up the faith and work up the emotion. It's you just come to a point like a little child. You say, well, here's the circumstances. I've done what I can. It's in your hands, God. You be the loving arms underneath me to take care of me. I can do this much and no more. And sometimes we have a very important part to play. But when we do that, where we are, we trust in God, as we've already heard. We just trust in God. What's typical is why. Why did this happen? Why did it happen to me? Why these people? Why this circumstance? How come Nebuchadnezzar has to pick on us three? We're the ones that are doing everything right. Why, if it weren't for us, he wouldn't have half the people that were bowing down, because we made the government of Babylon so efficient, so helpful, that people want to be a part of it. And you know, you can't win for losing. Man, it is not fair. It is not right. Well, this is the way this minister felt about the cancer. And finally, he weathered it, only to find out a few months later that he was diagnosed with cancer. That point, when he heard the news, he walked out of the doctor's office and he wandered over to a children's playground, sat down at a picnic table. He was kind of lost for time, you know, out of time and space. He was just deliriously confused and then upset that God would allow such a trial to happen. He said, I quote, did sit some uncomplimentary things to God. I sat down at this one table. I wasn't aware of who else was around. And I said, God, it's not fair. It's not fair. Some people have it once. I've got to go through this twice. It's not right. How can you allow such a thing? And then after about an hour of that, he wandered back down the street, went into the doctor's office, and it was like he never left. It was perhaps the staff understanding that, well, we've seen this with other people. So nobody said much, and then he discussed a protocol by which they advised him what he could do in order to fight this. And as it turned out, he survived it. And he says, I still don't know why, but it happened. I can remember, and this comes up all the time, frequently in society and even within God's church. I can remember another person that came down to Florida decades ago, and he had gone through some major trials. It was a trauma for him to be let loose from where he worked at this one mill up north for all of his life. He thought a few years later he'd retire and he'd have a retirement, but he and everybody else were unceremonially dumped. So he had nothing. Came down. And his wife was going through, seemed like, insoluble trials. And he was frustrated. And he would say to me after services, he says, can I talk with you? And I knew what was coming. And so we would talk outside because the building would be locked up. Everybody was gone. He says, this is what's going on. And what I want to know is why. Why? And he'd just keep going over this. And I didn't know why. And I had standard pat answers, but it didn't register. But he felt better for venting. And then that would be okay for a couple of weeks. And then he'd be like an emotional volcano ready to explode. And again, that would come across all the time. After everybody was gone, we'd sit there and for an hour I'd hear him ask, why? Why this? How can God let this happen? And it was a trial. He obviously didn't know how to handle it. And if I would try to show him different ways, even gently, and that would just aggravate him all the more. He wanted somebody to show up and say, this is exactly what's going on, this is why, and this is the easy way out of it, and it should have never happened, and you should have an easy life from here on out. Times of ease, times of patience, the times of the still waters, it says over in the Psalm 23, he leads me by the still waters, and that is part of life. In adversity, may occasionally occur. And sometimes adversity, what we thought was adversity, turns out to be no big deal on occasion because we've changed. There are times, as we've heard before, where we are approached by an angry storm and we want God to take care of the storm. And sometimes he will. And then there are other times when he instead chooses to calm the child so that the storm is not a big deal. When Peter walked on water, not that parable, but the other one where the disciples were in the boat with Christ, that happened numerous times, but there was one time when a raging storm came up out of nowhere, and Christ was totally relaxed. They had to wake him up. Master, don't you know we're ready to sink? And you could ask, well, how could burly, rough and tumble fishermen get intimidated by a storm? But on the Sea of Galilee, because of the rift in the Nile, the Jordan River, there is a wind tunnel, basically, that runs north-south. And when the weather conditions are just right, you can have a powerful wind come ripping through this canyon, which is the riverbed for the Jordan River, or the Jordan River Basin. And it comes right into the Sea of Galilee, which is only 12 miles across. But you can have a very intense, focused wind, almost like a tornado. And so when you're reading, it was quite serious. And yet the disciples were amazed that the master was totally asleep, not a care in the world. So Christ ended up calming the storm, which increased their faith. But Christ didn't do that for himself. Sometimes you have to calm the storm. Sometimes you calm the child. Well, here, this man that was talking to me, complaining and asking why, he wanted to calm the storm. And God wanted to calm him. And that did happen over time. He was more mellow. He was able to look at things differently. He had more patience. And so, in a bizarre way, you could say, well, it was a good thing. It changed him. We are a work in progress. God is working with all of us. We have to be patient with each other, and God is patient with us. And sometimes we don't know what our fellow brothers and sisters go through. And it's important for us to have compassion. There was a man that I knew years ago, also in the ministry. He was visiting with his assistant, who was all of 23, and he was in middle age at the time. They visited a 90-year-old cantankerous man who had hurt himself, and his leg was in traction, so his leg was suspended. He's in a bed, and he can't move. And when they got there, he was upset, and he was asking why, and he was cursing and swearing and just ranting and raving, and the senior man listening said, okay, how do you feel about that? Okay, all right. Well, an hour went by. I guess it's time to go, but we will be back. They got in the car, and the assistant said, boss, why didn't you lower the boom on him? Man, swearing and all that's unbecoming of a member, and he's been in the organization for a long time, and this doesn't make much sense. And the senior man said, you know, that's unfinished business. We will have to get to that gently. He said, let me ask you a question, though. Have you ever been 90 years old? No. Have you ever been in traction where you couldn't move your body and your leg was hoisted up in the air and you were stuck that way for weeks on end? Nope. Have you ever been in traction and been 90 years of age? No. He says, neither have I. So, let's be patient. Who knows what we would do if we were in that certain situation? I think we understand that as an organization today. I think there's much more maturity among the membership. Back when I first came in the church, I'll remember one man, he was about 60. He had been the Rock of Gibraltar. He had won the arm wrestling championship of the state of Texas and seemingly felt invincible for his early years. And then he was working on his car and carried the motor all by himself and slipped and tore a hernia in the side of his body. And from that day, he just went downhill health-wise. And one person came up to him at church and says, "I see you've gone through a few things. What's the sin? You know, what's the spiritual sin that you committed that brought you here?" "Oh, if life were that simple." Well, that was so grotesquely unfair. There probably was no sin. In John 9, there was a man who was healed from blindness. And Christ said, "Well, did he sin or did his parents sin?" Nobody sinned. You know, there are so many different reasons why some trials occur, and we don't know. And I don't say that these things happen, you know, every other day. I can remember one or two that I've gone through, and I cannot tell you why. It really doesn't matter. The key question is how. How do I get through it? How do I maintain my balance spiritually, my equilibrium? How do I say yes to God and yes to what I should and not be frustrated and not get emotional where that is unnecessary? How can I handle this? Sometimes people will have doubts. John the Baptist was in jail at one point. He sent a messenger to Christ and said, "Are you he that we should look for, that is the Messiah, or?" Christ gave him reassurance. "No, it's just as you originally thought." Sometimes we need reassurance. The value of coming to church can give us that. Being in tune with God, obviously, in His Spirit. All the people that were able to make the right choices had a relationship with God. They had a relationship. But over in Job chapter 7, when we talk about people that frustrate and ask why, this is common, and Job did this too. He was going through incredible challenges, and he had done nothing wrong. I mean, he was a righteous man. Self-righteous, that's true. But when he would look, "Well, did I not help the poor? Did I not help the widows? Their hearts, it says, they sang for joy. I never lusted after a woman," he says in another verse. And so in chapter 7 of Job, verse 1, he said in the frustration, "Is not all life a struggle? Our lives are like that of a hired hand, like a worker who longs for shade, like a servant waiting to be paid. I too have been assigned months of futility, long and weary nights of misery, lying in bed. I think, when will it be morning? But the night drags on and I toss till dawn. My body is covered with maggots and scabs." He was out possibly at the city dump. The only place that he could be escape criticism and scrutiny. "My skin breaks open, oozing with pus. My days fly faster than a weaver's shuttle." I don't know if you've ever seen a weaver's shuttle. You can go and Google that out on a computer. But you've got a loom. It's a weaving loom. You've got multiple threads, maybe 20, and you're moving it back and forth and moving needles around and lining up the next line of yarn or thread or whatever. And you put it together, a cloth, a tapestry, and people that are good at this can move very quickly with their hands, and they weave so many different threads together. And Job is saying very correctly, he said, "My days fly faster than a weaver's shuttle." And he viewed his life like a weaver's shuttle. Well, ours is that way. Ours, where in this analogy, every different thread is a factor that goes into our lives. And God will weave those different factors together to make a beautiful tapestry. Well, Job said, verse 7, "O God, remember that my life is but a breath, and I will never feel again happiness. You see me now, but not for long. You will look for me, but I will be gone. Just as a cloud dissipates and vanishes, those who die will not come back. Until the resurrection, and Job understood that too. But at least temporarily, be out of the picture. They are gone forever from their home, never to be seen again. In other words, is that what you really want from me? Because I'm just a thread hanging by a thread. I cannot keep from speaking, verse 11. I must express my anguish. My bitter soul must complain. Am I a sea monster or guard? I think, my bed will comfort me and my sleep will ease my misery, but then you shatter me with dreams and terrifying nightmares. And that may not be of God. People will start to, if they're feeling awful and they're frustrated, and sometimes they'll say things like the 90-year-old man I mentioned, or just blurt things out. I would rather be strangled than rather die than suffer like this, verse 15. I hate my life and don't want to go on living. Oh, leave me alone for my few remaining days. And that's the mindset that he was in. Easy for us in our comfortable academic environment here to say, he shouldn't have been that way. Well, that's true. And he repented of that and everything else. But he went through extraordinary suffering that most people never have experienced. And I don't know if anybody suffered more than who originally had done more for humanity. His life was legendary. But we know that it ended well, and God restored all of his wealth and allowed him to live twice as long for the future. And so when he looked back, he probably said, it's too bad that I really had to go through that rough and tumble period. But I'm glad that I had that experience because I'm a different person. I see God in a way I never did before. Job 42, verse 6. Now he said, God, I knew of you before. I'd read about you. I had communicated. But now I know you. Oh, it's so different. I'm a changed man. I'm better off. He says, I understand. And so he did. He was a changed person. God was able to calm him. And then once he was changed, the adversities didn't seem to matter. And once they didn't matter, then there was no more need to prolong the trial, and God removed it. Once he learned everything that there was to learn in it. But sometimes we don't always know why. Maybe we find out why later on, and maybe we don't. But when you have the mindset of the people at Dunkirk, or the three men in Babylon, but if not, no, I want to live on. I want to do so many things for my family and for other people and so on. And I'm trusting in God to heal me. But if not, I'm staying the course. I'm keeping my focus. I'm moving ahead. I want so much to live here. I want to do different things that I haven't done and all. But if not, I'll go elsewhere. Whatever it is, God has to know, wants to know, that we are committed for the long haul. And I think we are. I think we are. God has oftentimes a broader purpose in testing us than we ever know about. And David talked about Psalm 23, and he said that he walked through the valley of that, and we, some of us may or may not in the future. David did, even though he was young. He escaped Saul, who tried to kill him with a spear at least three different times, and then sent his army out after him. 3,000 men, the best of the best. It's like sending out the Green Berets or the Army Rangers or the Navy SEALs. And, you know, what chance does the normal person have against those kind of odds? And he retreated into the caves in South Judah. Didn't know if he would live or not. Well, yeah, God said that I'd be king, but I'm not. There's nothing that's going the way God said it would. And yet God, David had focus, and he was not going to lift his hand against God's anointed. By his actions, he was saying, they may try to kill me, and they may try to chase me, and I don't know what the outcome will be, and I hope God delivers me. And maybe there'll be a time for me to get my revenge, which is not what God wants. So if all those things unfold, so be it. But I will not succumb to it. I will not respond in the wrong way. I could, but if not, if God doesn't rescue me and work it out, I'm still going to follow what is right. What is right. So the question is not why so much as how do I get through this? How do I deal with it? Coping or whatever. In James chapter 1 and verse 8, I'll make just reference to it. It says a double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. It's double-minded to be obsessed with why when God wants us to be asking how. Where do I go from here? What proactive things can I do at this point? At this point. Well, we read in Hebrews 11 phenomenal examples of people that were committed to God. I'll turn over there in Hebrews chapter 11. We sometimes call this the Hall of Fame chapter of great men and women in the Bible that had done extraordinary feats or had extraordinary trust, that it was noted by God. In chapter 11, we start out with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then we go to verse 22. It was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, said confidently that the people of Israel would leave Egypt. And it was he that stood for the principles of God in spite of adversity in Egypt, in spite of being thrown into prison. He could have said, God, you're very unfair. You've allowed this to happen to me, and I've done very little wrong. But if you do not rescue me, I'll stay in this prison till I die. I don't know what the future is. Moses had his moments, his challenge. He had to get to the point where, if I go into the promised land or not, I'm committed for the long haul. I'd love to go, but if not, I'll die here at Mount Nebo. I'll have eternal life to look forward to. There were others. Some, verse 33. By faith, people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, received what God had promised them. They shut up the mouths of lions, referring to Daniel, quenched the flames of fire, which we read about, and escaped the death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned into strength. They were ordinary people. Were ordinary people. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Women received their loved ones back again from the dead. But others were tortured, refusing to turn to God in order to be set free. They placed their hope in a better life after the resurrection. Some were jeered at, and their backs were cut open with whips. Others were chained in prison. Some died by stoning. Some were sawed in half. And others were killed by the sword. Some went about wandering, wearing sheepskin and goats' skins, destitute and oppressed and mistreated. They were too good for this world, wandering over deserts and mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these people earned a good reputation because of their faith, their trust, and none of them received all that God had promised. For God had something better in mind for us so that they would not reach perfection without us. There is a statement in Isaiah, the Lord's arm is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear deaf that it cannot hear. It's in Isaiah 59, verse 1. And there were notable, valiant people of faith. When Elijah was discouraged, God explained to him, there are 7,000 knees that have not bowed down to Baal. In Acts 5, verse 29, the apostles explained when they were being chastised and beaten by magistrates in Jerusalem, they said, we must obey God rather than man when there is a conflict. All indication is that the two witnesses in the future are prophesied to stand up to the beast and the false prophet. And their whole attitude is, we're going to do the work that God gave us. And he can sustain us. And he will dramatically. But will he do that all the time? Bible indicates no. And so they'll be able to say, but if not, you know, we'll still stay the course. We'll still do what God wanted us to do. Righteous are bold as a lion. I think that's a nice Proverbs 28, verse 1. Bold as a lion. I don't see how any of us can be as bold as a lion unless we're close to God. How does that happen? It gets back to the basic things. Prayer, study, occasional fasting. To be as bold as God wants us to be. To be able to be bold in case God decides not to calm the storm. I remember one person who wrote, he says, in case we're imperfect, well, we all are, he says, there's a lot of ways of looking at our situations. He says, I am not judged by the number of times I fail, but the number of times I succeed. And the number of times I succeed is in direct proportion to the number of times I can fail and keep on trying. That was his view. In the Bible's view, I think it's in Proverbs 24, verse 16, where it says, the righteous person, one with a good heart, stumbles seven times. In Hebrew, seven oftentimes is, you know, numerous, means many times. The righteous may stumble many times, but he or she gets up again. Doesn't stay down. Gets up. The future is in front of us. And in some cases, the past is a bucket of ashes. In the case of Hebrews 11, the past is notable and worth memorializing for all of us. Vince Lombardi said, since we are imperfect people, or said we are imperfect people, he knew that coaching his football teams. He said, perfection is not attainable, not in this life. But if we chase perfection, we can catch excellence. You only live once. I only live once. Why not make of life all that we can? How do I manage? How do I overcome? How do I succeed in trusting God? These are things that the mature Christian is going to consider when he or she comes upon different trials. All the great men and women of the Bible had enough confidence to say, quote, but if not. Are we there yet? We're getting there. Matthew 25 is talking about the parable of the five wise virgins as well as the five foolish. Talks about the value of using the time to buy oil, in a sense, essential for spiritual readiness. We still have time to turn our lives around and ask God to be more involved in what we're doing. We have time to dedicate our lives around what we saw in an earlier scripture that we turned to. So let's go back and conclude with Proverbs 3. And again, go back and revisit verse 5 and 6. That'll be the third time today. But it's such a vital theme. And I know, I think, enough about all of us that none of us would want to live our future without identifying with this passage. Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart. These are the people that say, how? Do not depend on your own understanding. Our understanding isn't as broad as God's. Seek His will in all that you do, and He will show you the path to take. We may walk by faith and not by sight. We may sometimes walk through the valley of death, or maybe other smaller, less significant valleys. At any rate, God can steer us. Don't be impressed with our own wisdom. Instead, fear the Lord and turn away from evil. Should we ask God to help us in our challenges? Absolutely. However, we should always be willing to add that no matter what happens, even if we want God to help, we can also say, but if not, we know that there's great purpose for what lies ahead.